This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Upwest Arts, presenting Scottish fiddler Alasdair Fraser and cellist Natalie Haas in their first Portland concert, Saturday, January 28th at Aladdin Theater. This all-ages show starts at 8 p.m. and tickets are available at the Aladdin box office or Ticketmaster 503-224-4400 or Ticketmaster.com. More information at upwest@olympus.net. And you are listening to KBOO Portland, heard at 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, on the web at kboo.fm. My name's Diane. This has been Early Morning Gumbo. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned now for the KBOO Morning News.
Good morning. This is the KABU News for Tuesday, January 10th, 2006. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up this morning, the Supreme Court rules on pesticide use near streams where salmon spawn. Questioning by the Senate Judiciary Committee begins today in the Samuel Alito confirmation hearings. And in Turkey, more cases of bird flu in humans are causing concern. In Mecca, it is Hajj, and this evening marks the start of Eid Allah, the Feast of Sacrifice. Portland area weather today: rain, heavy at times with blustery winds, strong winds in the gorge, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, snow above 4,000 feet in the Cascade Range and on Mount Hood. Tonight, rain, heavy at times, heavy snow advisory, lows 35 to 40.
The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to hear an appeal of a ruling that banned the use of pesticides around western salmon streams. Patty Goldman of Earth Justice said there have been many attempts by the chemical industry and the growers to get rid of the buffers. We now know they will remain in place. U.S. District Court John Cunar ruled in 2004 that the Environmental Protection Agency had failed to consider the effect of pesticides on protected salmon. His ruling imposed a 100-yard buffer for aerial spraying and a 20-yard buffer for ground application of 36 pesticides, from agricultural sprays to household weed killers. His injunction also required that stores selling pesticides in 500 communities in the West post warnings about the potential effect of 7 common pesticides on salmon and steelhead. The signs read, "Salmon hazard. This product contains pesticides which may cause harm to salmon and steelhead. Use of this product in urban areas can pollute salmon streams." Amy Code of Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides said that while some of the original 54 chemicals do not appear likely to be a concern for salmon, the EPA was too quick to clear some for use, and environmental groups will probably have to go back to court to get the agency to reconsider.
Oregon's property compensation law, Measure 37, will draw renewed national attention today, according to the Salem Statesman Journal. The 7 justices of the Oregon Supreme Court will hear a legal challenge to it. Several states have compensation laws, but Oregon's Measure 37 went beyond them. It required government to either pay landowners for property value losses caused by regulations or forego regulation and allow development. The court has received 8 friend-of-the-court briefs, most from regional and national organizations, backing Measure 37 and championing property rights. Oregon's land use law protects farming and forestry on most rural land outside urban growth boundaries and curbs development. The justices will hear an appeal of a decision by Judge Mary James, who ruled October 14th in Marion County Circuit Court that the law violated 5 state and federal constitutional provisions. The High Court accepted the case directly, bypassing the Court of Appeals. There is no deadline for them to decide.
85-year-old farmer Jack Chapin established his own orchards of filberts and cherries on about 500 acres off Wheatland Road near Salem, including land farmed by his father. His 3 sons are also farmers. But Chapin is worried about how his livelihood will be affected by Measure 37. He is one of seven landowners and the only one from Marion County whose names are on the legal challenge to the measure that the Oregon Supreme Court will hear Tuesday. Chapin was active 3 decades ago and Oregon wrote statewide planning requirements, including the protection of farmland and tax laws favoring agriculture on land zoned for farm use. With $422 million of a statewide total of $2.7 billion, Marion County led Oregon's 36 counties in crop production in 2004. Chapin says, "We were holding a lot of prime farmland for agriculture, which is number one in this area. If they go and tear this all down, it will hurt agriculture badly, no doubt about it. It will start to be on its way out." Chapin is only to look across the road at a parcel that could be subdivided, even though he and his sons own most of the surrounding area. Despite a state law that bars counties from declaring farming practices as nuisances, Chapin said farmers face a losing battle with non-farming neighbors. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
A group of rural Salem residents, upset at a proposed relocation of a private school to their neighborhood, picketed outside the Marion County government offices yesterday. The group, called the Rural Battle Creek Road Association, is frustrated with the way the county has handled a Beekwith school request to relocate to a property not zoned for a school. Carolyn Childers, one of the picketers, said, "We're very unhappy with the bulldozing of the whole system to satisfy a request that doesn't even align with the county's own rules." Childers said she believes the county has been swayed by the school while ignoring several factors that prohibit the school from moving to the area. The county officials say it is simply following the administrative guidelines that all such requests undergo and a resolution to initiate discussions on whether the area's zoning should be revised. It doesn't give the school a green light. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
A Virginia-based firm that wants to salvage steel from old government ships is negotiating to buy land near Coos Bay. This also from the Salem Statesman Journal. Shipbreaking company Baybridge Enterprises is negotiating with the landowner Robin Stevenot, who has been so far unsuccessful with plans for a residential community on the site. Baybridge has said it expects to hire as many as 125 people at wages averaging $20 per hour. The ships are loaded with hazardous waste such as asbestos and diesel fuels, and their hulls may be covered with exotic species, many not native to Oregon. Craig Young, a professor at the University of Oregon and the director of the university-affiliated Oregon Institute of Marine Biology at Coos Bay, said, "I'm absolutely not interested in seeing it happen." Craig said he fears the industrial activity could contaminate the waters the institute uses to study marine life. The U.S. Maritime Administration is under orders from Congress to sell the ghost fleet of former naval and merchant ships that sits in the San Francisco Bay estuary. No West Coast shipbreaking yard exists, forcing the government to pay millions of dollars to have the ships towed to scrapyards in Texas. Baybridge wants to open an Oregon operation so it can scrap the ships and sell the steel here or overseas to South Korea, China, or India.
The Casper, Montana Star Tribune reports that the roundup of a group of Oregonians accused in a series of arsons in Colorado and Oregon began last year with the cooperation of one key informant. KBOO's Lisa Loving has more.
Sunday morning, a boat containing hundreds of tons of sulfuric acid sank and capsized at the bottom of the Yangtze River, the longest-running river in Asia. According to the official press reports, the sunken cargo boat contained at least 260 tons of sulfuric acid. This would be the fourth major chemical accident to affect...
A little technical difficulty there. And now again, the KBOO story that Lisa Loving wrote.
Referred to only as, quote, cooperating witness, unquote, by federal investigators, the alleged Earth Liberation Front insider knew names and dates and was willing to wear a wire to record conversations with other members. That led to 6 arrests in December, with 2 suspects saying they were ready to cooperate and a third allegedly committing suicide in an Arizona jail. The case illustrates how federal prosecutors frequently work a cold case, one that's old, slim on physical evidence, and involves a tight-lipped group of people living on the edges of society. According to those familiar with such investigations, prosecutors typically cultivate an informant who will surreptitiously record conversations with co-conspirators and then charge who they can. Quote, "The federal government makes a living off tapes and snitches," unquote, said David Lane, a Denver lawyer who practices in federal court. Quote, "It's absolutely standard operating procedure," unquote. Federal prosecutors also look for defendants facing potentially long federal prison terms to begin flipping or offering cooperation in exchange for leniency. That opens the door for additional charges. Kirk Engdahl, a federal prosecutor from Oregon, told a reporter, quote, "We gathered information from our confidential witness regarding Vail," unquote. A source close to the Colorado investigation said that information and the cooperation of 2 cell members almost certainly would move the case forward. The fires set October 19, 1998, to protest the expansion at the upscale ski resort, leveled the 2 Elk Lodge and restaurant on top of Vail Mountain. The fires also raised a ski patrol, headquarters, and several lift buildings. The loss was tallied at $12 million. Elf claimed responsibility for the fires in an untraceable email communique. For 5 years, it stood as the group's most destructive act of protest, one that a cadre of investigators focused their resources in solving. Authorities said William Rogers, charged in a firebombing in Washington State, used 3 different names. Rogers allegedly killed himself in December while being held in an Arizona jail, using a plastic bag to suffocate himself. One witness against Chelsea Gerlach and the others is Jacob Ferguson. According to Craig Weinerman, a lawyer for the accused, Ferguson is a, quote, cooperating witness, unquote, who took part in the arsons but has not been charged. Another witness is Stanislaus Meyerhoff, a high school classmate of Gerlach's, who has been charged but not for every crime he admitted to participating in, according to court pleadings. Quote, "Mr. Ferguson admits setting the fires and somehow he gets a pass," unquote, Weinerman said in court last month. Quote, "We should consider the source," unquote. Supporters of accused Eugene resident Kevin Tubbs say that he's been placed on suicide watch in solitary confinement since the death of William Rogers in December. I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO News.
The Senate showdown over the nomination of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court began yesterday, with Democrats signaling their intent to haul the conservative judge over the coals for his views on abortion rights and executive power. On the first day of what is expected to be a bruising week of hearings, Alito sat stony-faced as all 18 members of the Judiciary Committee made 10-minute opening statements. It was followed by a statement from Alito, whose appointment would represent an ideological swing to the right in the makeup of America's highest court. Barring any major revelations or a stumbling performance before the committee, Alito is expected to win a majority in the Republican-controlled Senate. However, the vote is likely to be much closer than the 78-22 majority that passed the nomination of the new Chief Justice, John Roberts. Democrats have not ruled out attempting a filibuster, a politically risky delaying tactic to try to stop the confirmation. Questioning of the nominee will begin this morning, but Democrats went on the offensive during their opening statements, promising to question Alito about his constitutional powers and the right to privacy, equal rights, and abortion, this according to The Guardian.
According to Reuters, U.S. officials can open personal mail arriving from abroad as part of the fight against terrorism and do so when they deem it necessary to protect the country. News of the little-known practice follows revelations that the government approved eavesdropping on U.S. citizens without judicial oversight after the September 11th attacks. Susan Trevino of the U.S. Customs Agency said, "Customs and Border Protection is charged with making sure that terrorists and terrorist weapons don't enter the country. The Customs Agency, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security." Customs and Border Protection's website notes that all mail originating outside the United States Customs Territory that is to be delivered inside U.S. Customs Territory is subject to customs examination. Grant Goodman, an 81-year-old retired University of Kansas history professor, drew attention to the policy after a letter he received from a colleague in the Philippines was opened and resealed by Customs and Border Protection and only then sent on to him.
About 100 people were evacuated from a busy four-block area after an employee found a homemade bomb in the bathroom of a Starbucks. No one was injured. The device, which was found around 1:15 p.m. Monday, was disabled an hour later. Residents were allowed back into the building, and police opened the street around the store. The San Francisco police said this was a good device. If it had exploded, it would have caused injuries or damage. They did not disclose the size or type of device found or its potential explosive capacity.
The Army is taking initial steps to expel dozens of reservists who failed to report for active duty. In effect, the Army is warning hundreds of others that they too could be penalized if they don't heed orders to return to active service. The proceedings mark a turning point in the Army's struggle to deploy thousands of soldiers from the individual ready reserve. The reserve is a rarely mobilized group that's now being sent to war zones in which some have resisted serving. These are soldiers who had previously served on active duty but not completed the 8-year service obligation. Unlike those in the National Guard or Army Reserve, they are not required to stay in training. Many have requested a delay in returning to service and have asked to be exempted or have ignored their orders. The Army began mobilizing them in the summer of 2004. The move reflects the enormous strain it felt in providing enough soldiers for Iraq at a time when it was becoming apparent that no early withdrawal was likely. So far, mobilization orders have been issued for more than 5,700 IRR soldiers since mid-2004.
15 Cubans who fled their homeland and landed on an abandoned bridge piling in the Florida Keys were returned to their homeland yesterday. U.S. officials concluded that the structure did not constitute dry land. Under the U.S. government's wet foot, dry foot policy, Cubans who reach dry land in the United States are usually allowed to remain in this country, while those caught at sea are sent back. The Cubans, including a 2-year-old boy and a 13-year-old boy, were rescued last week and were held aboard a Coast Guard cutter while they awaited a final decision on their status. The case presented U.S. officials with an intriguing legal question, and the way that it was handled outraged some Cuban-American leaders in Florida. The Cubans thought they were safe when they reached the old 7-mile bridge, but the historic bridge, which runs side by side with the newer bridge, is missing several chunks, and the Cubans had the misfortune of reaching a pylon from a section that no longer touches land. An attorney for relatives of the Cubans had planned to file an emergency request Monday to prevent them from being sent back, but did not act in time. William Sanchez said he was going to ask the government to review the question of whether the bridge constituted dry land.
Israeli Foreign Minister Sylvan Shalom expressed his opposition after Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz said Israel would let East Jerusalem Arabs vote, this from Al Jazeera. Mofaz said Israel would follow the policy of previous Palestinian elections, including last year's presidential vote, when it permitted a small number of East Jerusalem residents to vote in local post offices. The remainder were prohibited to vote in outlying suburbs in the West Bank. But earlier yesterday, Israel's internal security minister said that Israel will allow Palestinian candidates to campaign in East Jerusalem for the legislative election on January 25th, as long as they don't belong to resistance groups. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas decided to defy an Israeli ban on Palestinian campaigning in occupied East Jerusalem. Minister Gideon Ezra told Israel Radio that those who want to campaign in the area would have to get permissions from the Israeli police, stressing that Hamas candidates and supporters will be banned from electioneering in the city. Last week, Israeli police barred Palestinian candidates from campaigning in the city, drawing a call by the United States for the Israeli government to allow Jerusalem Palestinians access to the parliamentary elections. Israel had earlier warned that it would block voting in East Jerusalem if Hamas participated in the election. Israel seized and then annexed East Jerusalem after the 1967 Middle East War, but the international community still considers the area home to almost 200,000 Palestinians as occupied territory.
According to NASA, three of the most powerful hurricanes of 2005 were filled with mysterious lightning. The biggest storms of all hurricanes are notoriously lacking in lightning. Hurricanes blow, they rain, they flood, but seldom do they crackle. During the record-setting hurricane season of 2005, three of the most powerful storms, Rita, Katrina, and Emily, did have lightning, and lots of it, and researchers would like to know why. Richard Blakesley of the Global Hydrology and Climate Center was one of a team of scientists who explored Hurricane Emily using NASA's ER-2 aircraft, a research version of the famous U-2 spy plane. Flying high above the storm, they noted frequent lightning in the cylindrical wall of cloud surrounding the hurricane's eye. Both cloud-to-cloud and cloud-to-ground lightning were present. Indeed, the electric fields above Emily were among the strongest ever measured by the aircraft sensors over any storm. Rita and Katrina were not part of the campaign. Lightning in those storms was detected by means of long-distance sensors on the ground, not the ER-2, so less is known about their electric fields. The reason most hurricanes don't have lightning is understood. They're missing a key ingredient, vertical winds. A hurricane's winds are mostly horizontal, not vertical, so the vertical churning that leads to lightning doesn't normally happen. Blakesley says hurricanes are most likely to produce lightning when they're making landfall, but there were no mountains beneath the electric hurricanes of 2005, only flat water. It is too soon to say for certain what the missing factor is, and scientists will need months to digest reams of data gathered in this year's campaign before they can hope to have an answer.
Unidentified gunmen in western Baghdad have abducted a 28-year-old American journalist working for the Christian Science Monitor and have killed her Iraqi interpreter. Jill Carroll was abducted near the office of Adnan al-Dilemi, a Sunni Arab leader whom Carroll had intended to interview. The driver, who survived the attack, said he thought the men belonged to Dilemi's security detail, so he slowed down. One kidnapper pulled the driver from the car, jumped in and drove away with several other kidnappers huddled around Carol and her interpreter. The driver said they didn't give me any time to put the car in neutral. The interpreter, Alan Enuiha, was later found dead in the same neighborhood, shot twice in the head. No group has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, which is under investigation by Iraqi and U.S. officials, and there has been no word on Carol's whereabouts. Carol has worked in Iraq since October 2003 and has contributed regularly to the Christian Science Monitor since February 2005. She's also worked for an Italian news agency, ANSA, and the San Francisco Chronicle. She is the 31st journalist kidnapped in Iraq since the start of the war in March 2003, this according to Reuters.
Yesterday in Baghdad, American troops blasted their way into the home of an Iraqi journalist working for The Guardian and Channel 4. Firing bullets into the bedroom where he was sleeping with his wife and children. This from The Guardian. Ali Fadil, who 2 months ago won the Foreign Press Association Young Journalists of the Year Award, was hooded and taken for questioning. He was released hours later. Dr. Fadil is working with The Guardian's film on an investigation for Channel 4's Dispatches program into claims that tens of millions of dollars worth of Iraqi funds held by the Americans and British have been misused or misappropriated. The troops told Dr. Fadil that they were looking for an Iraqi insurgent who seized videotapes he had shot for the program, and they have not been returned. Dr. Fadil was asleep with his wife, their 3-year-old daughter Sarah, and 7-month-old son Adam when the troops forced their way in. He said, "They fired into the bedroom where we were sleeping. Then 3 soldiers came in, they rolled me onto the floor and tied my hands. When I tried to ask them what they were looking for, they just told me to shut up."
2 suicide bombers disguised as police infiltrated the heavily fortified Interior Ministry compound in Baghdad and blew themselves up yesterday during celebrations of National Police Day. The attack killed 29 Iraqis. The attackers died before getting near the U.S. ambassador and senior Iraqi officials at the festivities, but the blasts kept a particularly deadly week for American and Iraqi forces. Iraqi police also were searching for an American journalist who was kidnapped Saturday. The escalating violence after the parliamentary elections came as Iraq's Electoral Commission again delayed releasing results of the vote. At least 498 Iraqis and 54 U.S. forces have been killed in less than a month.
Preliminary tests today showed another person in Turkey has tested positive for a deadly strain of bird flu, raising the number in the country to 15, a health ministry official said. The number of people hospitalized with symptoms also climbed to about 70. 3 people died last week, but only 2 of those cases were confirmed to have tested positive. Turkey, meanwhile, stepped up an awareness campaign to combat the bird flu outbreak, with imams warning about the danger through Minaret loudspeakers and authorities distributing leaflets urging people not to contact fowl. The United Nations Health Agency so far has confirmed only 4 of those cases as H5N1, but it warned that each new positive test increased the virus's chances for mutating into a form that could pass from human to human and spark a pandemic. A senior World Health Organization official for communicable diseases said, "The more humans infected with the avian virus, the more chance it has to adapt. We may be playing with fire."
China has resolved to shift some of its foreign exchange reserves, now in excess of $800 billion, away from the U.S. dollar and into other world currencies. The move is likely to push down the value of the dollar. This, according to the Washington Post. As China's manufacturing industries flood the world with cheap goods, the Chinese central bank has invested roughly 3/4 of its growing foreign currency reserves in U.S. Treasury bills and other dollar-denominated assets. The new policy reflects China's fears that too much of its savings is tied up in the dollar. The dollar is widely expected to drop in value as the U.S. trade and fiscal deficits climb. China now boasts the world's second largest cache of foreign exchange and is on pace to see its reserves climb past $1 trillion later this year. Even a slight diminishing of the dollar as a percentage of those holdings could exert significant pressure on the U.S. currency. In recent years, the value of the dollar has been buoyed by major purchases of U.S. Treasury bills by Japan, China, and oil-exporting countries. This flow of capital has kept interest rates relatively low in the United States and allowed Americans to keep spending even as debts mount. Some economists have long warned that if foreigners lose their appetite for American debt, the dollar would fall.
Another toxic spill has polluted a major waterway in China, and a capsized boat full of chemicals could potentially cause further problems. FSRN's Dante Toza reports from Hong Kong.
Sunday morning, a boat containing hundreds of tons of sulfuric acid sank and capsized at the bottom of the Yangtze River, the longest-running river in Asia. According to the official press reports, the sunken cargo boat contained at least 260 tons of sulfuric acid. This would be the 4th major chemical accident to affect a Chinese river in the last 3 months. Last week, Xiangjiang River was polluted by an industrial cadmium spill. According to the state-run Xinhua News Agency, at the height of the spill, cadmium level was at 25.6 times greater than the safety standard. Cadmium is carcinogenic and is extremely toxic even in low concentrations. Media report indicates that water will probably not be shut off along the route of the cadmium spill. As for the sunken boat containing hundreds of tons of sulfuric acid, there have not been any reports of the recovery of the boat by either of the official news agencies. From Hong Kong, this is Dante Toza for Free Speech Radio News.
And finally, a dead woman was positioned in a chair in front of a television set for 2.5 years because she told her caregiver that she didn't want to be buried and planned to return. Her caretaker and friend, whose name's not been released, left the woman upstairs in the home with the television and air conditioning on while the body slowly decayed and mummified. Some family members continued to live downstairs in the house since her death. Police went to the house last Wednesday after a relative who hadn't seen her in 2.5 years called him. They found the staircase behind a door blocked by a basket and climbed to the second floor where they found the body. Investigators said they had not determined the cause of death but found no signs of abuse or foul play. Authorities are working to determine whether any crimes were committed. The caretaker and family members apparently did not benefit in any way by keeping their deceased relative. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 10th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on Translator K264AA. 91.9 FM in Hood River on Transitor K220HR. Don't forget, join us tonight at 5 o'clock for the KBOO Evening News. Remember to take a look at the website. And if you want to volunteer in the AM News Department, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, rain heavy at times, blustery winds, strong winds in the gorge, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, snow above 4,000 feet in the Cascade Range and on Mount Hood. Tonight, rain heavy at times at higher altitudes, heavy snow advisory, lows 35 to 40. Coming up on KBOO this morning at 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. The topic is Bush, Cheney, and the consolidation of executive power. At 9 on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews Amy Bender, author of Willful Creatures, a collection of surrealist short stories. At 9:30, her Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies speaking on dual occupations, Iraq and Palestine in Bush's empire, a lecture she gave in Portland in October. At 10:30 on stage and studio, topics are The Seagull by Artists Repertory Theatre and Charlotte's Web by the Oregon Children's Theatre. And at 11, join us for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Topics include the Alito confirmation hearings and the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.